Hello and welcome back to the Wellness Wisdom Podcast. We're glad that you're here with us this week, and we are doing a continuation and final episode on our brain health series. Today, we're going to be talking about toxins and how they affect your brain health, as well as talking about some of the upcoming research and pharmaceutical drugs for Alzheimer's and dementia, and giving you some warnings about things in the medication field as well, and then talking with you about what you can do to help a loved one who has Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, any type of neurodegenerative disease, how you can help them out in their daily schedule and things like that. So today I want to welcome our three coaches to the panel, Jane Phillips, Tracy Guerrero, Kathy Riley. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
As always, just a little bit of a disclaimer. Any information here today is for educational purposes only. Please have a conversation with your licensed medical professional before making any changes. All right. So the first thing that I want to talk about today is the environmental toxins. So in our last episode, we talked about some toxins that come into the body via food and how detrimental those can be to brain health. So today we want to focus on outside environmental toxins. According to the EPA, the indoor air is 2 to 5 times more contaminated than your outdoor air. Not only do these chemicals pollute the air that we breathe inside, but they leach into things like countertops, floors, carpets, sinks, walls, furniture that we have, and we absorb them into our bodies when we come in contact with them in our skin. So things like personal care products that we're using in the shower, lotions that we're putting on, cleaners that we're using to clean our house with. Okay, those are all examples of what is making our indoor toxic. Okay? 90% or more of household products actually contain harmful chemicals. Chlorine is something that is extremely toxic to neural health. The chemical toluene, which is found in air fresheners, can harm central nervous system and cause brain fog in the short term, but it can cause brain damage in long-term use. How many people have those plug-in air fresheners that are constantly putting toxins into the air all day long, right? Or they go around and they're spraying Febreze.
Tide laundry detergent. My daughter loves her Tide and it just drives me bananas.
Yep. And laundry detergent, the strong scents that are in there.
My husband was using those Febreze balls, scent balls or something that you put into the, I suffered from the most massive headaches whenever he used them. They're not in the house anymore, regardless to say, but the Febreze, the air fresheners, if I get in somebody's car with one of those plugged in, I'm going to have a problem.
Yeah, me too. We switched all of our products in our house to organic chemical-free products from a company that I'm a customer of. And since then, like when I go to the grocery store, go down the aisle, like if I have to go get a scrubby or something from the laundry aisle and cleaner aisle, I have to hold my breath because it is so overwhelming. But I never realized it until I got rid of all the daily chemicals in my house that I was exposed to.
Yes.
You know, so, and it took probably about 6 months for that new sensitivity, I guess, to set in, but it's amazing what you can smell. And of course, when they're sitting in your house, they're off-gassing, right? And for our listeners who don't know what that is, off-gassing is literally those chemicals are leaching through the plastic bottles that they're held in. Just because they're in plastic doesn't mean that they're completely locked in and you can't smell them. Like they are leaching into your house, whether you're using them or not. So, and you never notice that until you take it all out. And then you start walking down there, you're like, okay, I know all of these bottles in the grocery store down the cleaner aisle are sealed, but yet I can smell them, right? So it's crazy.
And speaking of off-gassing, we didn't even put this in our notes, the VOCs.
Yes.
You know, the paints and the carpets and new furniture and things like that. If you, all of those things off-gas for quite some time, if you don't buy low VOC type of product.
Yeah. And that's the VOC, volatile organic compounds.
Thank you.
And a lot of times people just think, okay, well, I'll just take everything out of my house and put it in my garage, right? But if you're spending a lot of time in your garage with the door down and not a lot of air going through there, you're still being exposed to those VOCs. And that's where a lot of the VOCs are. You also have VOCs in like your furniture. So making sure that you're setting furniture outside for a period of 24 hours to 48 hours to air out before you bring it in is always a great idea, especially mattresses. And there's a difference between VOCs in chemicals that are harmful for us and VOCs in things like essential oils that are good for us. So yes, in essential oils, you have VOCs, and the volatile organic compounds are the things that are actually working to help you with your health and things like that. So there's a big difference between the two. I just want to make sure that we let our listeners know that there's a good and there's a bad. Okay. Many people don't know, and I learned this 20 years ago, that the active ingredient in Lysol in most brand of sanitizers for your home, spray sanitizers and things like that, contain BAC, which is, I can never pronounce this right. So I'm going to try. Benzalkonium chloride, and it can cause neural toxicity. Lysol is also a product made by Monsanto, who has multiple legal issues concerning their cover-up of products that contain dioxin. Dioxin is one of the main ingredients in Agent Orange that was used in Vietnam. So you are literally using that in your home when you're spraying and trying to sanitize the air and, you know, your doorknobs and your toilets and stuff like that. It is so much safer to use something that is herbally based, like a sanitizer that has thyme or thymol included in it, because it works just as well. It kills the same things, the same viruses and bacteria up to 99%, just like the brand Lysol does. So if you have a loved one that has served in Vietnam and has any type of neurodegeneration going on, any prostate cancer, any coronary heart disease, you have to take time to look into these as potential causes. The VA has actually linked, they have the research and they link these as far as VA disability claims for veterans who have been exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam. And you literally only had to be, have your feet on ground in one of the exposed areas for a 24-hour period in order to claim that disability.
Well, my father was living proof of that, served in Vietnam, and he actually passed 12 years ago from a brain tumor, glioblastoma.
And that one of those is linked. That's something that's linked to that. Yep. My dad ended up with prostate cancer, and that's actually what ended up getting him his 100% disability, because we were able to find where he had set foot on a continent that had been exposed to Agent Orange for 24 hours. So other than that, they wouldn't process it until we found that information.
Wow. We always suspected that as a cause, but he also was an avid Diet Coke drinker. Mm-hmm. So hard to differentiate there, but yeah.
Sure. Another thing when it comes to chemicals is exposure to environmental toxins like cigarette smoke, polluted air, pesticides. So if, like for me, we live in farmland heaven in the middle of the Midwest. So all of the chemicals that are sprayed on the crops throughout the year, you know, down south as well, if you're living around crops that are sprayed constantly throughout the year, you know, these are things that are going to affect and negatively impact brain health, and they can lead to cognitive decline like Alzheimer's disease. And additionally, the research shows that exposure to certain toxins during critical periods of brain development can lead to developmental disorders and brain defects or birth defects. So this can happen in utero. This can happen after birth. Essentially, once you get pregnant, that baby is being exposed to toxins consistently. So it really becomes important to minimize the amount of toxins that you're exposed to, and therefore your uterus is exposed to and the baby is exposed to. So it really starts there. It's like, when we're born, like, we don't have a fighting chance. We're just constantly
exposed. I was going to say, isn't there research showing that there's 180 different chemicals found in an umbilical cord?
Yes, yes,
yes, yes, absolutely.
That's the average.
Mm-hmm. Horrible.
So, yeah, detoxing, getting all this stuff out of your house, especially if you're trying to get pregnant or have little ones, you know, much less as you get older, like us, sure. like we are, right. you know, you just get rid of it, period.
And the most recent on that research has been also been diving into PFAs being found in umbilical cord. Well, so I know I've always educated those clients who come to me with PCOS, it's detoxing and eating the proper foods to help them with that PCOS and be able to get pregnant and have a family. So it's huge. All right. So we also have some of the research that we found has neurotoxicity associated with traumatic brain injury, blasts, chemical, a heavy metal, and quinoline drug exposure. Okay. So chronic excessive exposure and accumulation of neurotoxic agents like heavy metals, which would be lead, mercury, cadmium, manganese, mefloroquine, and food additives like monosodium glutamate, MSG, and aspartame, which we talked about in episode 2, are known to cause neurotoxicity and brain damage. The chemical-induced brain damage closely resembles the pathophysiology of a classic traumatic brain injury with decreased cognitive function, neurodegeneration, and increased psychiatric manifestations. So depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances, and irritability, all caused by chronic neurotoxic agent exposure. Right? Current evidence supports strong causal relationship between military-related exposure to specific neurotoxins and the development of serious medical conditions and higher rates of suicide among service members. Okay? They've really recommended to address the current deficit in military healthcare is efficacious, non-toxic, neuroprotective, and neurodegenerative agents like highly bioavailable magnesium, nutritional lithium, zinc, selenium, boron, ascorbate, tocopherols, heavy metal chelators, and glutathione precursors like NAC to be used as protective shields and to support critical healing processes in the brain and nervous system of those in the military. And those apply to everybody out here as well who's not military. You know, these are all things that you can take. The research and the science is backing all of this up. High levels of manganese itself can cause Parkinson's-like symptoms. So if you have a loved one who is suffering from Parkinson, I would definitely get some blood tests done to check and see the levels of manganese, copper, iron, all of these different things and see where they're at. Copper and iron toxicity can cause neurological dysfunction as well.
Yeah, and reading that Dr. Amon article that you linked, Shannon, that was kind of startling. The reported dementia cases are actually caused by mold exposure, he was saying.
Yeah.
And Alzheimer's, and that's just being misdiagnosed, right? Because if you're going to Western medicine, they're not going to be testing you for mold exposure.
Right, and they're not going to be testing you for nutritional deficiencies Correct. Or overloads either. So that's why it's important for us to talk about this during this episode, because I want our listeners to understand, if you have a doctor who's saying your loved one has Alzheimer's or dementia, these are things to be educated about and talk about and say, okay, well, what about this? Can we check for, you know, nutritional overloads or nutritional deficiencies? Can we do genetic tests? Can we do, you know, chemical sensitivity tests? You know, all of these different things, because, and even especially mold, because 90% of housing in the military has mold. Massive mold, so much that they are starting, they have a bill that they have passed. They are going to be redoing all of the housing, the barracks and everything on military bases starting this year.
And he also was mentioning about how many of the buildings in Washington, D.C. mm-hmm. have molds.
And then how old they are.
Right. But then I was thinking, well, that makes sense with our government. Maybe that's the issue.
Good point.
That's just saying.
That's a very
I think I love that.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
interestingly, there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a reason why he's bumbling around.
Right. Right.
Oh, One of the other research things that I found too was that not only is it in utero and, you know, with newborns, but if you are a breastfeeding mother, all of the chemicals that are leaching into your body are also going through your breast milk into your baby as well. Now, let's not take that to the extreme and listeners start freaking out going, oh my goodness, I can't breastfeed my baby anymore, right? It is still the best thing for your child. You just have to be aware of this. And the importance is to limit the amount of chemicals that you, the mom, is being exposed to, especially, right? And to do things like, you know, looking into heavy metals and the levels of heavy metals in your body and doing a proper detox, a slow chelated detox and things like that to help out, okay?
And like we were saying too, you know, you want to start that prior to you getting pregnant, you know. I mean, of course, we all have surprises, you know, where you weren't expecting it. But I mean, do everything you can to protect you and your baby prior to getting pregnant.
Yes. And really, the bottom line in multiple studies that we have looked through, showing environmental neurotoxicity results from the inhibition of mitochondrial activity, excessive oxidative stress, which leads to neuroinflammation, that means inflammation in the brain, and that it promotes apoptosis, which is neural cell death. Okay? And once your brain cells die, there's no bringing them back. There's no generating new brain cells. You can repair the neural connections in the brain and the neuroplasticity in the brain, but you can't replace dead brain cells, okay? So it's really important to protect them. The next thing I want to talk about a little bit more in depth is, you had brought it up, Tracy, was mold, you know, and how mold is affecting the brain. This is one of the biggest issues when it comes to brain degeneration. So many people, like we said, are not aware of it. And it's just across the board is an issue for many people. You know, I have experienced mold. Kathy, I know you've experienced mold. We've heard Bobby talk about being exposed to mold multiple times, you know. So, Kathy, how about you kind of lead us through the research that we found on this and what it means?
Sure. Research is suggesting that mold exposure is linked to cognitive impairments, including memory, concentration, and attention span difficulties. Changes in behavior, such as increased irritability, mood swings, anxiety, depression, and difficulty sleeping, have also been reported in individuals exposed to mold. When inhaled or ingested, the mold produces mycotoxins, which is a toxic substance that can affect the nervous system. According to PubMed, mold exposure may contribute to the development or worsening of certain neurological disorders such as multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's. Neurotoxicity and the central nervous system mycotoxins are released by certain molds and have the potential to directly damage the central nervous system, leading to neuropathy, nerve damage, tremors, dizziness, coordination problems, and even seizures in severe cases. I was actually doing some research on this, and I listened to Dr. Andrew Campbell, who we've discussed a few times, who has a serum mold test, and I found his slides on a presentation I went to with him several years ago, and it was talking about, you know, the different short-term, long-term memory, autistic spectrum disorder, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, oh my goodness, loss of balance, facial pain, head and neck pain, movement disorders, and decreased visual acuity were some of the things that were mentioned in one of his slides. It's a huge issue. And we all know that is sometimes, like you said, misdiagnosed because the Western, you know, medical practitioners are just thinking, you know, they've got Alzheimer's or dementia, early onset dementia. So it may or may not be that. It might be mold.
The webinar that you went to, right? Like that could even point to someone who may possibly be suffering from signs of stroke, you know, like the gradual signs of stroke that somebody's exhibiting, you know, because it affects the neural system, you know, the whole central nervous system. So if you, I would say in that space, obviously someone is exhibiting stroke symptoms, you want to get them to help quickly, right? But do not rule out that the possibility may be that it's being caused because they're in a mold inhibited environment.
Right.
You know, so really important.
Yeah.
Take much with our homes being built of, you know, drywall and wood and everything. It's literally like a drop of water that can start building up behind just areas that we would never suspect.
Yeah. Ice makers. You know, a lot of people have found that their ice makers were leaking and they weren't aware of it because, you know, who checks behind your refrigerator? You know, right. I know a lot of people have just opted not to have an ice maker because of that reason.
Well, and that's why I don't like drinking anything out in a restaurant, you know, like even water or having ice in it, because a lot of times their ice makers can have mold build up in them and them not even know it.
Yeah. Oh, they have shown some of that on social media. It is terrifying. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
What do you mean? They're putting a slice of lemon in there so you don't know it.
Right.
The sky's the taste a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit of sarcasm there.
We need that in this world.
Today.
That's the only way we survive is with a sense of humor.
Yeah. And Tracy, you said you had some information about ozone therapy.
Well, my fascination has always been with ozone. I have used it repeatedly for here and there. My daughter has also used it. We are lucky enough to have a practitioner here who's one of the top three in the country on ozone therapy. So I think it has so many uses that are undiscovered yet, or actually they're discovered. We're just kind of not talking about it, right? So ozone therapy has a lot of controversy out there around it, but this was interesting in direct relationship to neurodegeneration. This is a study out of NIH that was talking about ozone having shown potential in preventing or improving neurodegeneration by targeting oxidative stress-related mechanisms. And my mother-in-law is suffering from Parkinson's, gosh, for about 10 years now. She's at the end. But even before I had known about this, I had told my husband, I said, gosh, it'd be great if we could find somebody who did ozone therapy in Texas that we could do that with. But his family's not real comfortable with those kind of, they're very Western medicine minded. So that probably wouldn't have gone over well, but I was just thinking the benefits that she could receive from ozone therapy. And sure enough, they've started to study this. And there is indeed a direct correlation in showing some improvement. So I just thought that was interesting to note because it's so well known for healing during chronic inflammation. My daughter, for example, had cellulitis in her toes. She was a dancer and needed to perform. In 2 days, we took her to get ozone therapy. They injected it directly into the site. Literally, it was very, very swollen. And there's no way she could have danced on it. It started sliding up her foot. We did an ozone therapy. We injected it directly into the site. Literally, within 4 to 6 hours, you would have never known anything happened. It was crazy. It's crazy.
Wow.
That is so fascinating.
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. No.
I find it fascinating as well. And I just think it's so understudied and so just doesn't get the recognition that it needs because it has so many amazing benefits.
Well, and it really boils down to it being able to counteract that free radical oxidative stress that's going on in our body. You know, oxidative stress, it kills, you know, you've got free radicals that are attacking your cells. They're literally killing your cells. You know, so to be able to counteract that and your cells be able to have that extra support, that extra army behind them, you know, to be able to continue doing what they're doing, reproduce healthy, like that. It's definitely understudied.
Well, underrated, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for it to take something like that, if she had to go on an antibiotic, that would have been a 10-day course of antibiotics.
Yes.
With ozone, it was 4 to 6 hours.
And then you're trashing your microbiome too.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it doesn't end at that 10 days. It's, yeah, you're repairing after that.
It's, oh, yeah. They say it takes up to a year and a half to repair your microbiome after being on a round of antibiotics.
Holy crow.
Wait, how long? What did you just say, 10 years?
A year and a half, no.
Oh, a year and a half.
Yeah, yeah, well, even a year and a half. Think about it, right? Put it in perspective. It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a long time.
So, and that's just for one round. So if you're doing multiple rounds, you might as well multiply.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's probably exponential even, you know, I mean, it's not just 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I want to end with a quote for this section talking about toxins and how they affect brain health. The simple truth is that we are living in a sea of toxins and it is destroying our bodies and brains. And that's a quote from Dr. Hyman.
And but we also want to say we can't live in fear with all of this, y'all. I mean, I want to stress that. I can't stress that enough. We could walk around literally in fear 24/7. And all we can do is the best that we can do every day. And it's just being mindful, right? It's just being mindful of the things that are in our house that we're being exposed to, that we're putting on our body, that we might be consuming inadvertently. Do the best you can and try to minimize your exposure. But literally this, I mean, we are surrounded by a sea of toxins and that can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Make healthy lifestyle choices. Yeah. Do the things now, do the best you can. And live your best life.
Yep. Just worry about what you know is within your control, your home, your car, your kids. You know, obviously you can't control what's in and out of your workplace, right? But you can control those things, the things that you are most involved in every single day, your food, things like that.
Your bedroom. Think about your bedroom. You know, you spend 8 hours a day in your bedroom. So, you know, start at home.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's dive into the next section, talking about pharmaceutical drugs in relation to brain health. So we're going to look at some of the medications that are given to dementia and Alzheimer's patients and what they do. I also want to make our audience aware of some of the over-the-counter drugs that elderly people should not be taking. Okay, so I found a list of drugs that are actually linked to dementia. And this was very, very interesting and kind of scary. So the medications that have been associated with increased risk of dementia include the overactive bladder medications, antidepressants, IBS meds, pain medications like opioids specifically, and NSAIDs, so your naproxens, okay? Heartburn medications, and certain anxiety medications. Now, these certain medications are linked to an increased risk of dementia, but doesn't necessarily mean that they cause dementia. It's just another arrow that you're throwing at the body, okay? And the risk of dementia with these medications increase when you take higher doses and over longer time periods. So your risk is minimal if you're just taking, for instance, you know, a pain medication once every in a great blue moon. Like for myself, I take Aleve maybe once every 2 months, you know? So obviously me compared to someone who's taking an Aleve or something like that every single day for pain, their, you know, potential is going to be a lot higher than mine. Okay. There's five drugs or five drug types that are known through research and studies to cause memory loss. Benzodiazepines, which are generally prescribed to calm anxiety and agitation. These drugs can also interfere with your ability to transfer information from your short-term memory to long-term memory. Okay. Beta blockers. A lot of people are on beta blockers for high blood pressure because they're used to reduce hypertension. They're also used to treat conditions like congestive heart failure. However, they affect chemical messenger agents in your brain, which help you pay attention and process information, okay? Then we have tricyclic antidepressants, and these meds are prescribed for a wide range of conditions like depression, anxiety, helping you to quit smoking, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and a lot of eating disorders, among other things. But the Women's Brain Health Initiative reports that memory loss occurs in about 1/3 of the people who take them because the drugs will block the action of neurotransmitters in the brain. Okay. That's scary in itself.
Yeah,
it is. And next on the list is the narcotic painkillers, so your opioids. Okay. They're obviously great for knocking out moderate to severe pain, but they're not great for their memory because, again, they're something that can interfere with both your short-term and your long-term memory. Anybody who's ever been on one, you can absolutely see how that's possible, right? Antihistamines and your NSAIDs, like I said, need to be avoided. So, and again, this is one of those things where if you're just taking an antihistamine every once in a while, you know, no big deal. But if you're someone who lives on an antihistamine all year round because you've got allergies, you're at a much higher risk. And here was the surprising one. Okay, surprising for probably our listening audience. I don't think it's surprising for any of us here on this panel. Statins. Statins lower your cholesterol levels, but in doing so, they also deprive your brain of cholesterol too. And your brain uses those cholesterol lipids to form connections between nerve cells. There was a study done, and of the 60 patients identified who had memory loss associated with statins, 36 received simvastatin, 23 atorvastatin, and 1 pravastatin. And about 50% of the patients noted cognitive adverse effects within 2 months of therapy. 14, which is 56% of the 25 patients, noted improvement when the statin was discontinued. Memory loss reoccurred in 4 patients who were re-challenged with the drugs.
Wow, Shannon, that's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yes. So with some of my clients, I have suggested for them to, especially if they have been on a statin for a long period of time, and let's say they've been on it for 5 to 8 years, and they've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years that that's when the memory loss and the difficulty has started to happen. I always suggest they go back and have a conversation with their cardiologist about this, mm-hmm. because it could be the statin that is causing this. And so to look at alternative options, supplements that can help them. And I want to direct everybody back to our recent heart health episode that we released in the beginning of February, where we talk about the necessity of cholesterol and that the cholesterol numbers that typically are being looked at aren't necessarily true. And there's another way to look at those numbers, because as you age, you need more cholesterol. So your cholesterol levels are naturally going to be higher because your brain needs them. Your hormones need them. That's how your hormones are created, with cholesterol. So as we age, our hormones drop, body produces more, you know, so take a look at that. Be aware of something like this, because this is huge. A huge amount of the population is on statins today. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a rise in dementia and Alzheimer's. Is there a connection? Well, it's very well possible, you know, so it's definitely something to look into with your loved ones if you're experiencing this. One of the questions that I asked was, is it really a neurodegenerative disease that's showing, or the effects of medications, not just statins, but like some antidepressants? So some antidepressants, antipsychotics, cardiac medications, antispasmodics, antivertigo medications, and even antiparkinsonian medications have anticholinergic effects. The toxic effects of anticholinergic medications on the brain is Alzheimer's, dementia mimicking effects, which include confusion, memory disturbance, agitation, and even delirium.
Herein lies the problem, because my mother was on tricyclic antidepressants for many, many years. And so now in hindsight, you think, well, could that be it? I mean, it could be, it's multifactorial, I'm sure.
But right. Could this be what triggered?
There it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about the prescriptions that are out there for dementias and Alzheimer's right now. And so I just want to be clear with our audience. There is no medication currently that's going to stop or slow down or reverse dementia. Some of them can temporarily help a person with their memory and their thinking. This is a conversation that my sister and I had to have with my dad, because the VA was recommending that he take a clinical trial drug that they were part of. And he was specifically told, you probably won't see any difference, but there's a small chance. And if you want to take another prescription and you want to see if that small chance applies to you, then we'll give you this prescription. Which blew my mind, because I'm like, but you just said it's probably not 98% chance it is not going to do anything. So now we're taking a medication that could be potentially creating multiple side effects, because there was a lot of side effects to it.
Or a 2% chance.
Of a benefit.
2% chance.
Right. So this is really something that has to be weighed. And of course, the person who is suffering with Alzheimer's or dementia, even if it's early onset like my dad, they want to grab at that, even that 2% chance that something could help. Right. And I mean, you can't blame them. But you know, my personal opinion was don't do it. I got outvoted. So, you know, a healthy brain contains natural chemicals that allow nerve cells to talk to each other. One of these chemicals is called acetylcholine. When a person has Alzheimer's disease or dementia, they have less acetylcholine in their brain. This means that their nerve cells will lose the ability to talk to each other properly. Cholinesterase inhibitors result in higher concentrations of acetylcholine in the brain, which is going to be leading to increased communication between nerve cells, which in turn creates the temporary improvement or stabilization of the symptoms of dementia. Okay. So some of the medications that you typically will see prescribed for your loved one is donepezil or Aricept, galantamine or Razadine, rivastigmine or Exelon. All of these are cholinesterase inhibitors that can be used to treat all stages of Alzheimer's. So they're going to increase the acetylcholine in the brain. Okay? Memantine or Namenda is the only FDA-approved drug currently to treat moderate to severe Alzheimer's. And this works by blocking the effects of a chemical called glutamate. Now, glutamate is responsible for sending messages between nerve cells in the brain. Nerve cells damaged by Alzheimer's disease make too much glutamate, which can cause more damage. So this helps to reduce that. Okay. Leqembi is a new category of medications that has recently been approved by the FDA to treat Alzheimer's disease due to its showing in studies that it can reduce the amyloid beta plaque, which is the typical marker of Alzheimer's disease in the brain. Abilify is an atypical antipsychotic that can treat the agitation that's caused by severe Alzheimer's. All of these, obviously, like we just talked about, contain side effects. And again, it's up to you as an advocate for your loved one to help them determine whether or not, especially in the early stages, not so much in the end stages, because a lot of like the cholinesterase inhibitors won't work in the end or middle stages of dementia and Alzheimer's. But if you're in the beginning stages or early onset, you know, it's worth a try for these, but you have to weigh the benefits of side effects versus what you may see, you know.
And that reminds me, when you were talking about the amyloid plaque, there's actually studies showing that enzymes, systemic enzymes like nattokinase and lumbrokinase, can actually help to degrade that plaque. So that might be, you know, an alternative for folks to look into.
Yes. And that's definitely an alternative to look into even when you're younger, if you see the potential in your family for this happening or with the lifestyle that you're leading, to start early on to help reduce the continued, you know, amyloid plaque.
Yeah. And then I saw the choline stearase. We were talking about that yesterday because my husband had a terrible reaction to anesthesia and he was told he had a choline stearase deficiency. So I'm going to dig into that a little bit more and see if we might be able to raise his choline.
Yes, absolutely. That would be very important to check out.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's something for, or how did you find that out with him? Did you do like a genetic test with him or?
Well, that's what they told him at the hospital after he was paralyzed from the anesthesia they gave him. So I don't, I never really dug into it. That was 20 years ago before I got into, you know, the health and wellness field. So, well, yeah, I definitely am going to look into it more, especially seeing that it's linked to Alzheimer's.
Right.
He was paralyzed with by anesthesia.
Yes. And they told him he had a choline sterase deficiency.
Wouldn't that be something they might could test for prior to administering?
Well,
good luck.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, that's pretty severe paralysis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was supposed to be an outpatient surgery, and he was in for 3 days.
Well, speaking of that, there are some tests that you can do to test your compatibility with pharmaceuticals. So, Kathy, I know you have dug into that a little bit. So,
just a little bit. I actually was recently introduced to this test. It's done by Toolbox Genomics, and it is actually testing your genetics. So, you would have to do, I guess, a saliva sample. I'm not actually sure, but I believe it would be a saliva sample, kind of like the 23andMe genetic testing. And they can actually go through and see what SNPs you have, which might contribute to some medications working for you or not working for you. And I've always talked about, you know, some people are like, they can take a pixie dust amount of a medication and they get a reaction from it or a supplement, you know, and then there's other people who need double the dose. And this test actually goes into those different aspects of it. It's looking at some of the samples where, you know, it'll tell you if you're going to have a strong reaction to it, if your liver will metabolize it correctly or, you know, not enough or too much.
Too fast.
Too fast. Right. There's an example here. For instance, Zoloft. Individuals who are poor metabolizers may have a higher plasma concentrate and decreased clearance, and you can reduce the dose by 50% if you have this particular SNP and can't, you know, are getting too much of the Zoloft. Also looking at codeine, a combination of Zoloft and codeine, if you should be cautious of that. Let's see. Talks about different antidepressants, proton pump inhibitors, antifungals, antidepressants, antipsychotics, opioids, all of these things. And it'll tell you if you should continue taking this particular medication or maybe change to a different one. So there's a lot of information in this test if you're concerned about what medications you are currently taking and see if there might be something that you could change to that would be more suitable for your genetics.
That's a great find, Kathy.
Yeah.
I think I would recommend that really for everybody to look into because, you know, like my mother-in-law, she broke her hip. And one of the things that I noticed, the rest of the family didn't really notice it, but the fact that the pain medication that my mother-in-law was on was not working. And I knew it was because her liver was metabolizing it too fast, like within 30 minutes. I mean, it was just gone, you know, she was getting very, very slight effects of it. So this would have been a test that would have been fantastic to have, you know, and to be able to let the doctors know, hey, you know, here's something that's better for her. Or if you're going to use this, it has to be a double dose because of her metabolism, you know, things like that. So I would suggest that really for everybody to look into because then you're prepared. If you have to have surgery, if you have to have a pharmaceutical medication, like, you know, automatically genetically how your body is going to react or not react to it.
Yeah. And it's really not that expensive. I think it was less than $300 to have this test done. Nice. So
nice. I think though probably the reason why they don't do it in like hospitals especially or doctor's offices because of the amount of time that it takes to analyze those genetics. It can take sometimes 3 and 4 weeks to analyze those genetics. So it's definitely something to get done ahead of time, not when you're in the thick of things.
Of course.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to have a division of the hospital that just does that so that you can, you know, just they have these trained people to handle that, the testing.
Right?
Yeah,
it'd be great. Mm-hmm. It would be one way that, you know, functional naturopathic medicine, holistic medicine can combine with conventional medicine, you know.
But, I mean, yeah, they could, the hospital itself, they do their risk assessment. They're less at risk if they're not, providing these medications that are creating harm.
So. Yeah, but, that also takes the bottom line from the pharmaceutical companies, and then you get the insurance companies involved. So, yeah, won't happen. But, all right.
Okay, I've got one more resource for us. I was actually talking to one of my friends last night, and she brought this course up that she wants to take. He has her book, and it's talking about nutrients, heal your biochemistry and heal your brain. Natural healing for ADHD, autism, behavior disorders, depression, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's. The book is called Nutrient Power, Heal Your Biochemistry and Heal Your Brain by William J. Walsh, W-A-L-S-H. So I just thought it was so timely that she brought this course up to me in this book that I could share it with you all today as well.
Absolutely. And we can post that in the show notes so that everybody has that link, as well as on our link tree, because I think that's a super important resource for people to have. We're also going to, we have a brain health quiz that we have put together, that you can it's just some questions to ask your loved ones, or you'll go through yourself and just see what your risk percentage is for a neurodegenerative brain disease. So to keep in mind, and you can take it continually, as you get older, and see where you fall into that. So we will link that to our show notes, as well as linking it to our link tree and our social media. So I want to end this episode with talking about how we can care for loved ones with neurodegenerative diseases and what the expectations are, as well as talking about tips for changes in communication and behavior for people with dementia. Right? So. And Jane, I know you're going to help me out with this. So I'm just going to go through a list of things, tips that I found. And then we can talk about, and I know Kathy, you've got experience with this as well. Talk about actually dealing with people with Alzheimer's or dementia or their loved ones. So, all right. So as we've stated before, unfortunately, all neurodegenerative diseases are quote unquote incurable. And it's impossible to reverse any brain cells that have been killed, right? Some neurodegenerative diseases are treatable depending on why they happen. Some of these conditions are treatable directly, so you may be able to manage, limit, or slow their effects. Other conditions aren't treatable directly, but it may be possible to treat the symptoms and improve the quality of life. That's the difference that you're going to run into when you're in a doctor's office and they're telling you your loved one has neurodegenerative disease. These are the two options, okay? Early on in Alzheimer's and related dementias, people experience changes in thinking, remembering, and reasoning in a way that affects their daily life and activities. Eventually, people with these diseases will need more help with simple everyday tasks like getting dressed and eating. This may include also bathing themselves, brushing their hair. And it can be upsetting to the person going through this because we're independent, right? Like, we don't want help doing these things. It's almost like that reverse lifeline where, we're a baby, we're a toddler, we need help with these things. We're independent most of our life. And now we're going back to needing someone's help and doing everything. And eventually even, going to the bathroom and things like that, right? So it can be very upsetting for someone, rightfully so. So here's some tips that you can consider early on in the disease process, okay? You want to help someone by trying to keep a routine for bathing, for dressing, and eating at the same time every day. You want to help the person write down to-do lists, any appointments and events, either in a notebook or a calendar, or both, whichever is going to be easiest for them. Plan activities that the person enjoys and try to do them at the same time each day, so it's still a schedule. Consider a system or reminders for helping those who must take medications regularly. I know for some family members, we have a pill box that has alarms on it, and you can do multiple times during the day that they need to take things. So there's separate boxes for those, and they'll set an alarm off, and everything else is locked except for that one that goes off during that alarm. So they know exactly what to take Obviously, as things progress, you're going to help them divvy up the medications and supplements within those. That's something I fight with my dad all the time. He insists on doing his, and we know he's not doing them correctly. So you want to plan, when dressing or bathing or grooming, allow that person to do as much as they possibly can before you jump in and help. And if possible, let them ask you for help. Don't just kind of do it for them. Okay. Buy loose fitting, comfortable, easy to use clothing, clothes with elastic waistbands, fabric fasteners, or large zippers to pull instead of having to tie shoelaces or do up buttons or buckles. Use a sturdy shower chair to support someone in the shower who's unsteady, to help them prevent falls. And you can also, you can buy those at like drugstores and medical supply stores. You can also get like the grippy pads for your shower as well, or the bathtub. Be gentle and respectful. Tell the person what you're going to do step by step while you help them get bathed or get dressed. And this helps to re-encourage kind of what steps they need to be taking in the brain. It's kind of like trying to reteach them things in the brain when you're saying things out loud. They're hearing it. Okay. You also want to serve meals in a consistent, familiar place and give the person enough time to eat. Don't rush them through eating. Especially as it gets, goes along in the process, they're going to lose function of how to use a fork and a knife and things like that. So anybody have anything else to add to that?
Patience, just a lot of patience, kindness, love, understanding.
Yeah.
One thing we didn't mention is the sundowners syndrome. You know, Jane, you're nodding your head. If you want to go into it, I have not experienced it personally. You're muted, honey. But yeah, I've heard it's awful. So I know it's a very common occurrence with people who are dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I wanted to pipe in for a minute because years ago I did home care, right? And so I had two clients, basically two sisters, one of whom was a chain smoker and the other one didn't really have much in the way of mobility. And the other one had full blown Alzheimer's. And so, you know, sister wanted to keep her home as long as she could. And I understand that. So I would go in and I would help them with the activities of daily living, including running errands for them, you know, going grocery shopping and such. So I have experience with that, not only with them, but with my mom. I mean, my mom ended up going in the nursing home. So that was something that I had to more or less advocate when I was there, or calling frequently to see how things were and everything. So that was, you know, it's a different scenario there. And and the client was kind of like an intermittent sundowner, if you want to call it that. So she kind of went back and forth between being awake during the day, being awake at night and things like that. And so there are a lot of challenges there. And I was able to kind of bring her out of her intention to leave. She wanted to leave their apartment often. So I would go along with it and I would say, well, yeah. Okay. You're going to go to so-and-so's house, but you haven't brushed your teeth yet, or you haven't had lunch. What are you going to do? You need to, you need to do that first. So that would go a long way in getting her out of that intention of leaving. So it was pretty interesting how that worked.
Yeah. I just looked up some ideas that you can help with sundowners. Reduce the noise, clutter, or the number of people in the room. Try to distract the person with a favorite snack, object, or activity. Offer a drink. Suggest a simple task like brushing your teeth. Make early evening a quiet time of day. Play soothing music or read or go for a walk. And adjust the lighting. Allow the natural light during the day. Try a softer room lighting in the evening. So those are just some quick tips that I found on the internet. Since we brought it up, I wanted to share some tips to deal with it.
And just for our audience, in case they don't understand what sundowners is it's increased confusion and restlessness in people with dementia in the evening time frame around dusk. So if you notice someone becoming more agitated as the day goes along, this is where the sundowning or sundown syndrome comes into play. It's not a disease. It's just a set of symptoms that can include anxiety, agitation, hallucinations, pacing, wandering, and disorientation. It makes someone with dementia feel very, very strongly that they're in the wrong place. And it's most commonly associated with Alzheimer's disease, but it's also found in other forms of dementia as well.
You know, this is interesting. I was listening to all the sundowners symptoms, and I'm obviously familiar with it. But I'm going to bring pets into this because they suffer from that as well. Sure. I have a dog who's 16, and every afternoon, late afternoon, I'd say around 5:30 or 6, I noticed the pacing begin, the obvious confusion begin. It mimics a human remarkably. What's going on in their brain and how confused they are. And bless his heart, we were talking about just distracting him and bringing down lights, you know, playing soft music. I do all of that. And I also give him like a lick mat or some kind of little puzzle toy that he can engage himself with. But our pets certainly suffer from this as well as they age. And I think it's important to point that out and recognize them as well. It's a struggle.
I think that's a great point, Tracy. Thank you for that. I mean, until you said it, I didn't really connect it, but now you've said it. I mean, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. It's hard to watch. It's hard to watch humans and our pets.
Absolutely. I think it's also harder if you have someone, a loved one who has Alzheimer's or dementia early onset, or they're in the thick of it, and then they also have an older dog that they depend on emotionally, but then is also older, like you said, you know, 15, 16, 17, and they are experiencing it as well. Right? I mean, that makes it even harder. So, all right. So I want to talk about just tips for changes in communication and behavior for people with dementia. Communication obviously can be hard for people with Alzheimer's and related dementias because they have trouble remembering things. They also can become agitated, anxious, and even angry. Some forms of dementia, language abilities are affected so much as they have trouble finding the right words or trouble speaking, finishing sentences. Obviously, you as the caregiver might feel frustrated, impatient, want to finish their sentences. I'm guilty of doing that with my dad. But it's important to understand that the disease is causing the change in communication skills. And so to make communication easier, you can reassure the person, speak calmly, have patience, listen to his or her concerns and frustrations, kind of just be that sounding block for them, that sounding board, and try to show that you understand if the person is angry or fearful. Don't become reactive to their anger and their fear. Allow the person to keep as much in control of his or her life as possible. Respect the person's personal space. Build quiet times into the day along with activities. Keep well-loved objects and photographs around the help to help the person feel more secure and to also help them remember, especially close family members who are taking care of them. And remind the person who you are if he or she doesn't remember, but try not to say, "Don't you remember who I am?" Encourage a two-way conversation for as long as humanly possible. And try distracting the person with an activity such as a familiar book, or a photo album, you know, if you're having trouble communicating to them with words. One of the other things too is making sure if you have someone who is in the early stages of this, it is very important that either before they hit these early stages or in the very beginning of these early stages, that you make sure you have the proper legal paperwork filled out and ready to go for when they hit the point of they are no longer able to either one, care for themselves, drive themselves somewhere, take care of their finances, things like that, so that you can be that proper advocate for them and make the important decisions for them. That's one thing that has upset my family is that my dad refuses to give any of that over. And he, you know, in his decline, I mean, we're powerless. So it's just something that you need to have a discussion about it with your loved ones, especially beforehand. You know, if you've seen it happen with their parents, for instance, you know, it's worth having a conversation with them now. I want to be prepared. I want to make sure that I am taking care of you in the way that you want to be taken care of if something like this should ever happen.
Also, yeah, this is so important, Shannon. Thank you for bringing that up, because with my husband's mother right now, we're struggling with some of that. And I'm asking some questions. We're talking about burial versus cremation, and none of them have any idea of how she might feel about cremation. Having some of these difficult conversations early on, like you were saying, is so crucial, because the last thing you want after they pass is to be second guessing your actions and the actions that you took. You were doing what you thought was best, but don't we want to know what they want, right, ultimately? So it's so important.
Absolutely. And it's created a lot of fights, you know, with my dad, frustration, you know, and him trying to come to the terms that this is happening, you know, and a lot of it has to do with his, you know, being in Vietnam and everything he was exposed to and everything, you know, but, you know, it's been really hard to try to get him to acknowledge this is not reversible. This is happening. You got to make lifestyle changes. Please make lifestyle changes, you know, and not being willing to, and, you know, and he's by himself. My sister's, you know, close by, but he still lives by himself. And we worry about when he drives, you know, we worry about when he goes out. We worry, I mean, just the loss of memory. I mean, I've had conversations with him in the last several months, and I've brought them up again a couple weeks after, and he does not recollect the conversation we had at all. So it's going very quickly. And the fact that he will not give us any indication of what he wants or help us control what's going to happen to him at a certain point, it bothers both of us.
Yeah. It reminds me of one thing. When my dad was ill last year, and he's doing much better now, but, you know, we bought him one of those life alert necklaces, and he wore it for a couple of months, and he's like, he didn't want to do it anymore. Right. So I saw a device on Facebook the other day that you actually plug into the outlet. It's a motion sensor, and it's very, very, you know,
sensitive.
Yes. So, I mean, you can put it in the bedroom or something like that. Maybe buy a couple of them. So you have one in the bedroom, bathroom, wherever.
Door.
Yeah. Yeah. See if he's, when they're leaving, but at least you would know that they're up and moving around, you know, without, you know, having the life alert.
Yeah, and do you know the name of it? Do you know the name of
it? Oh, no, I'd have to look it up again. Like I said, it was just one of those things that popped through on my feed. It's like, oh, that's interesting.
Right.
Yeah. I never really thought about a motion detector, but I mean, it's like kids, right? Like when you have kids who have, especially autism when they're younger, right? Like you're trying to put the locks on the doors, the sensors, the alarms, motion detectors and things like that. So essentially going the same way as your parents get older, but trying to do it in a way that they don't notice all the time. Because that makes them angry and they can get frustrated, right? But at least it gives you the sense of security and the sense of, okay, they're fine, you know.
And one final thing, just in reference to the mold that we discussed, there is a good documentary called Moldy, M-O-L-D-Y. You can find that on Prime and YouTube. You might want to take a look at.
Awesome. Good resource. All right. Well, I think that has been, it's been a wonderful episode to end out our three-part series. And we hope that the education we have given you has helped our listeners tremendously. If you have any questions, if you want to talk to somebody about this, you want to look into holistic options or just how you can have better conversations with the doctors your loved ones are seeing, don't hesitate to reach out to us. We would love to talk with you. You can find our contact information in the show notes and reach out to us at our websites as well. So for this episode, we hope it finds you well. And until our next episodes, we're actually going to start doing a series on prepping and medications and health and things like that. So those are coming up next. So we hope you enjoy those as well. Until then, we encourage you to help your loved ones make decisions, you know, just take this information we've given you and just dig into what's important for, you know, what your loved ones are going through, make those early preparations and be well. Everyone have a fantastic week, and we will be back soon.